In nearly all cases with modern health systems, you're waiting months for appointments only to spend a mere 10 minutes with a doctor who quickly hands out a generic diagnosis that is likely rooted in a total misunderstanding of health and causes, and then you're offered a one-size-fits-all medication or invasive treatments with unpleasant side effects. If this sounds all too familiar, consider a different approach with the New Biology Clinic, founded by Dr. Tom Cowan, a respected natural health doctor, author, and speaker. Dr. Cowan's holistic perspective on health and wellness and a deep understanding of the true nature of health and disease sets this clinic apart. With the New Biology Clinic, it's not about quick fixes and suppressing symptoms. The practitioners take time to understand your unique story, recognizing that health is unique to the individual and that illnesses have a variety of causes, physically and metaphysically. Members of the New Biology Clinic enjoy a flat monthly fee that includes a range of valuable services like health consults as needed, practitioner-led live streams on diverse health topics, access to a members-only resource library, and multiple live group sessions every month. These sessions cover fitness, breathing integration, biofield tuning, guided meditation, EFT tapping, and much more. Unlike traditional healthcare systems that thrive on frequent visits, prescriptions, treatments, and suppressing symptoms, the New Biology Clinic's motivation is to make you healthy and keep you that way. Visit newbiologyclinic.com to learn more and use code THEWAYFORWARD for $50 off your account activation. If you're a member of The Way Forward, email hello@thewayforward.com to receive $150 off your account activation. Your journey to genuine healing begins here. Dr. Katie Deming, the conscious oncologist, is a radiation oncologist, inventor, and TEDx speaker who is transcending the boundaries of conventional and integrative medicine to evolve the current paradigm of disease prevention, treatment, and healing. She blends conventional medicine with holistic practices and ancient wisdom to address the hidden roots of disease and activate the body's innate capability to heal. And it's pretty amazing that I think within the last few podcast episodes, you're the third or fourth person that I'll be talking about having like a near death / shared death experience, which is weird that that keeps coming up. And you're the second MD that I've interviewed who sort of came to understand the pseudoscientific nature of the germ paradigm on your own accord, which is pretty incredible. But yeah, it's weird that this keeps coming into my field. I don't know what it is about that, but I'm really excited to hear your story and your shared death experience, as you call it.
Thank you. Well, I'm excited to be here.
So let's get into it, because being where you are now, having been an oncologist steeped in traditional cancer research and fully bought into that paradigm, and now, you know, on your podcast, you've interviewed the likes of Gerald Pollack and Veda Austin and other people. Let's start with your story on how you sort of woke up.
Sure. So I am a radiation oncologist. That's my training. And I practiced for 20 years. I also was a healthcare leader and specifically interested in design. So designing healthcare that is easy for people to navigate was kind of my thing that I was interested in. And I had done that, you know, for 20 years and had been very successful. And I was really kind of at the height of my career. In 2020, I had been nominated to become the medical director for one of the largest healthcare organizations within the U.S. and running all of their cancer care. So in that position, I would have been in charge of cancer care end to end from, you know, the whole spectrum of prevention and screening that now I wouldn't necessarily call it prevention screening, but that would have been in charge of that whole spectrum and had spent like 5 months interviewing for this position. Ultimately, it came down to me and one other woman, and another woman got the job. And I knew when that happened, I was like, I'm not meant to build something within the system. And within like, it was literally within like a week or two that I had my shared death experience that just turned my life completely upside down. And what happened was, is that a shared death experience is similar to a near death experience in that it is transformative and something that really changes people's perspective on life and death and, you know, everything in between. But the person who has the experience is not the person who dies.
Right. So you weren't the one who died or nearly died. It was someone that you were near that had it, and you were immersed in that experience with them.
That's exactly right. And typically, these experiences, when they happen to healthcare professionals or emergency personnel who are at the scene of someone else dying. Mm. And I had never heard of this until it happened to me, but mine was a little bit different in that I was not at the scene. It happened actually during a meditation for me. And it had happened where I was meditating one night and a woman's voice came into my awareness and she was talking to me and saying, I can't let go, but it's not because of me, it's because of them. And I knew instinctively that she was dying and that she was talking about her friends or family and that she couldn't leave them. Mm. And I just instinctively knew this because in my career, I've cared for over 5,000 people with cancer, and about half of my practice was palliative, about 40%. So I spent a lot of time around people who are dying, and I just felt comfortable, you know, okay, this is what's happening with her. And I started talking to her and I said, you know, there's no rush. You'll know when it's time, and I'll stay with you. And so I just sat with her in meditation. And I don't know how long I was in meditation, maybe about 35 to 40 minutes. But at some point in the meditation, I saw who this was. And the woman's name was Misty. And I didn't know her personally, but I was connected to her through her best friend. So Misty was dying of breast cancer, and she was in her early 30s, and her best friend was one of my colleagues. And I had been helping my colleague care for Misty. So I had been kind of coaching her on how does she make sure her wishes are met? How does she make sure she can stay home? How does she make sure she doesn't have treatment that she shouldn't have? Those kinds of things. And then also coaching my colleague on how do you deal with losing a best friend in your early 30s? Most of us are just not prepared for that. Mm-hmm. And so I was connected or entangled in this way with Misty. And so I saw at some point it was her, and I just stayed with her. And then eventually at some point during the meditation, I started to feel something pulling away from her body, which now I would best describe as her soul. Mm-hmm. And I could feel this pressure. And all of a sudden, I heard these pops, like pop, 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 like strings popping. And as soon as the last string popped, she gasped. The sky above me opened up, and I was all of a sudden engulfed in like the brightest, most beautiful, loving light. Like, you know, some people describe being in the sun. It was like that. It was so bright. I had no reference for it. And when she gasped, she said, oh my gosh, I never had to worry. It's so beautiful. And she was, I could feel that she was like crying. She was so just moved by this experience. And then she was gone. And I was just in this space and just bathed by these frequencies of love and light and joy. And it's really indescribable. I have no words for it other than to say it was so beautiful. And I don't know how long I was there because time doesn't exist in this realm. And so I was there for some period of time, and then I came out and I was like, what just happened? I literally had no reference for it because I was a traditional, conventional medical doctor, not, you know, at all into the spiritual stuff. And so I wasn't sure at all what had happened. And I was kind of afraid to tell my husband, like, I hadn't, you know, and I hadn't been doing drugs. It wasn't like I was doing anything.
How long had you been meditating?
I had been meditating for probably a few years at that point. So I
was
had
this
a
more
meditation
of like
a
mental meditation thing than it was a sort of spiritual connection meditation or?
Yeah, I was basically, I would just use my breath to center myself and get into the silence and empty myself out was really my practice with meditation. And so I didn't tell my husband. I went to sleep. And then the next morning when I woke up to a text. And the text was from my colleague. And the colleague said, "Thank you so much for all of your help with Misty. She died last night." And I didn't know. I hadn't heard from my colleagues in weeks. And I was just like, oh my goodness, do I tell her? What do I say? Like, I didn't even know what to say because she's going to think I'm strange. I also didn't want to upset her. Like, I didn't want to tell her something that would be upsetting. And I wasn't sure if it would comfort her. And so the only thing that I thought to ask was, I said, you know, do you know what time she died? And so when she told me the time that she had died, it was within minutes of me coming out of that meditation. And for me, that was confirmation that what had happened was real. Because I think if that hadn't happened, I might have brushed it off and just said, I don't know what that was. But having that confirmation made it clear that, oh, that was really something that happened. And for me, it's kind of like a dividing line where things shifted after that. And I would say, I think my awareness shifted. And it's almost like I see us as little antennas for information. And it was like that event tuned my antenna. Mm-hmm. Like all of a sudden I was like really clear. And what was clear was like, not what is truth. Like, I don't know that there's a truth with a capital T, but like what was true for me all of a sudden became very clear. So that's really the event that shifted everything for me.
Mm. Did that experience also tune you to be able to discern what is very clearly not true?
Yeah. Well, and this is, I think, this is one of the things that I think, one of the reasons why I share my story is because I think for people who are awakening, we think that maybe when it starts to happen, you're going to see what you are supposed to do. But the truth is that in my experience, is that more often than not, we only get clear information about what's not true for us anymore.
Right.
And that's what happened for me, is that I realized after this event, what we're doing in Western medicine is not healing. Mm. It is not what the body needs to truly heal, and that I needed to leave.
Wow. Was that pretty instantaneous, or was there a period of cognitive dissonance? Was there a lot of unraveling that had to be done?
Yeah. Well, what had happened is that I had started, the knock had started in 2019, where I had been getting the messages that I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing, and I was ignoring it. Mm. So what happened was, is in 2019, I just started feeling so disillusioned with medicine and what was happening, and that I just couldn't understand, like, why are we having younger and younger people coming into my office with cancer? Why are cancer incidence rates increasing if we're doing such a good job? It was just frustrating, and I didn't understand it. And I had said to my husband, I think I'm supposed to do something different. And it made zero sense because I didn't have my first job until I was 32 to, you know, train and
become.
You've
been doing this for 20 years now, right?
Yeah. So as a radiation oncologist, you know, to just even finish my training and get my first job, I was 32. And then I, you know, had a lot of student debt, and I basically had spent my whole life training for this, that my husband at the time had said to me, you know, I wonder if it's just that you're not happy. Like, maybe it's not about what you're doing, because if you look at your life, you're doing meaningful work, you're treating people with cancer, your colleagues love you, your patients love you, you make a great living, we have a beautiful life. Like, why, if you're not happy with all of that, maybe there's something inside you that's never going to be happy no matter what you have. And so I had internalized that for about a year and being like, okay, maybe it's me, maybe I'm never going to be happy. But what happened with this event is that it just like made it all very clear. No, that was a message, you know, from my higher self before trying to show it to me, but I wasn't ready to make the hard decisions to shift that. Mm-hmm. And so this event really made it clear for me that I knew I had to leave. But then, I knew that that was going to have ramifications. I knew that my husband wasn't going to support that transition. I knew that I was, my lifestyle was dependent on my career. I had student loans. And I also had this mistrust in what I had been trained into. And so I was afraid to go get any other kind of training. Like, I didn't want to just jump into another fellowship to learn a different
right.
type of medicine, because I was just not sure that I was going to be taught something that also wasn't right. And so I knew that I just needed to take time, and I needed to explore what really makes the body healthy. And because everything I had been taught is about pathophysiology, what makes the body sick, and using medicines, or in my case, radiation, to fix them. And so I knew that I just needed to create space to explore. And that was going to require a lot of undoing in my life.
So I have a question about the pathophysiology. What were some of the general things that you learned in pathophysiology that make the body sick?
Well, I mean, we're taught, and I have to speak mostly from a perspective of cancer, because that's where most of my training and education lies. But we're taught that cancer is related to DNA damage, nuclear DNA damage. And in my practice, I specialized in women's health, so breast cancer and gynecologic cancers. And I knew that that just wasn't the case, because I would tell my clients when they would say, well, it doesn't run in my family. And I'd say, yeah, breast cancer, only 5 to 10% are genetically related. 90% of the time are considered sporadic, meaning we're not sure exactly why it happened, which means we have no idea.
That 5 to 10% doesn't seem like a very strong correlation either. And you hear that so often, that, oh, this seems to be a genetic thing. Your genes just happen to be effed up. And so that means your daughter's genes might be effed up too. She'll be predisposed to cancer. That sounds absurd to me.
Yeah. So, and that's exactly what you see too, is you can have a BRCA mutation and it doesn't penetrate, it's not everyone gets it. So it's more than just the genetics, even when there is genetics involved. But clearly I knew that 90% of the time it was not genetically related, because that's what I was telling my patients. And that was what was so frustrating, is to say, I know that we're told that cancer is a genetic condition, but it's not the case for most people. And so that's one of the things that in cancer that we're taught that's just not correct.
And what do they say is, or what were you taught is the primary cause of this DNA damage?
Well, so it could be genetic. So it could be something that, is hereditary, or it could be related to environmental toxins or smoking.
So they did acknowledge environmental toxins. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So in that year that you took off after this shared death experience, what were some of the, for lack of a better term, rabbit holes that you went down that rang to be more true? Or, and also, what were some of the things you'd previously bought into that became a very, very crystal clear that they are not true?
Yeah. Well, I think the first one is really looking at cancer as not an inherited disease. So that was a piece of it. But for me, when I started researching what makes us well, I started looking holistically at emotions and the mental and the spiritual aspects of it, because those are pieces that I was not taught about at all. And the part that really surprised me was the correlation between emotional trauma and illness, and big studies. So like the ACE study, or Adverse Childhood Event study, that looks at children. And what they did was they looked at the number of adverse childhood events, which could be like a divorce of a parent or, you know, physical abuse, mental abuse, sexual abuse, a lot of different things.
A list of like 16, of,
yeah,
right?
There's a long list, but
I took that and I had like 14 of the 16.
Right. So you basically, the children had who had the higher ACE scores had higher incidence of cancer, obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, depression. And even if you, they took out factors that you'd think like, okay, well, maybe if someone had an addiction, then that's going to influence, you know, because children who have experienced emotional trauma. But even if you controlled for that, these children still had higher incidence of illness. Mm-hmm. And I had never been taught anything about the connection between emotions and cancer. And so that for me was a big one. And then looking at going into the radical remission data, Kelly Turner's work of looking at people who've healed their cancer without conventional treatment, you know, she basically compiled 10 factors that these people are doing that are in common. So it's correlation, not causation, right. But looking at things that these are things that these people are doing in common. And two of them were related to emotions. And wow. One was releasing past trauma and the other was facilitating positive emotions. And for me, this was the most upsetting part of it because I realized that how we were treating cancer, number one, we were missing the mark on the causes of what may be contributing to cancer and missing this whole component of the emotional piece. But then also, we were perpetuating trauma on people mm-hmm. through the diagnosis. So giving someone a diagnosis of cancer is like, you know, having a bomb go off in their head. It's, you know, it's all of the fear, all of the, you know, emotional turmoil and the emotions that come up with that, and then forcing people into these algorithms and saying, you have to do this, and pushing them through really quickly to make decisions. And I can say from being on the other side as a healthcare administrator, you know, we think we're doing a good job because there's these metrics that, right. You know, the longer between the time of diagnosis and surgery or time from surgery to chemotherapy, the worse outcomes. And so we're thinking we're helping people by shepherding through the system so quickly. But actually, all of this, I think, is further traumatizing people and taking away their power even more. Mm-hmm. And so for me, the more that I started to study, the more I just felt like sick to my stomach, like, oh my goodness, how do you even start to solve this problem? Because the system is so strong of what's there and people have become so conditioned to believe in the system, right? But this is where it all kind of started to unravel. So for me, emotions was a big piece of it. And then as, you know, a lot of this has started to evolve as I started my practice. So I needed to start to see people to really see how it would work in action, you know, because it's one thing in theory when I'm studying this stuff and I'm coming up with ideas, but then it's another when you have people in front of you and you're working with them. And ultimately, I've really come to believe that all of the things that we do are important. So healing is by definition bringing wholeness back to the being, and wholeness, you know, requires an approach that's emotional, mental, physical, and spiritual. But with all of those pieces, like all of the things that we do, like the doing for the healing is important. But what I've come to realize is that consciousness supersedes all of that. Mm. And that even if someone, so Nita Mirjani's story is a very good example of that. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with who she is. She's an incredible story. So she died of lymphoma, basically had lymphoma throughout her body, ended up dying of that and kidney failure related to it, and had a near-death experience. During her near-death experience, she connected with her higher self, also connected with her father. And she realized that she had created the illness in her body through the fear. She had, her biggest fear in life was of getting cancer because her best friend had it and her brother-in-law. And ultimately, when she had this experience, she realized that she had manifested it. And if she had created it, she can also heal it. And so she came back into her body. Within 2 weeks, all the tumors melted away and she walked out of the hospital. And now she teaches people, you know, that healing is possible and it's never too late. And that's an example of someone who, she didn't do anything. It was literally her consciousness connecting with her higher self and realizing who she was, that she came back in and in her body spontaneously healed. And she says something that is really beautiful. She says that the moment that I realized I didn't need to be healed is when I was healed.
Wow. That is profound.
So for me, and this is like, I think it's a hard concept for people to grasp. And this is why I think healing is possible for anyone, anytime. It's never too late. Like Anita's a perfect example of that. She basically died of the cancer and then came back and healed it all. But most people won't do it because they have other things that are blocking their level of consciousness to be able to access that. And so that's what my practice focuses on. Practices that are in the physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. But what I focus on is helping people balance their body by getting the right nourishment that most of us aren't getting because we've been disconnected from the natural environment that we were designed to thrive in. And we've been bombarded with toxicity. So it's a matter of detoxing the body and then also giving the right inputs. And if you do that, then the natural product of that is that people start to connect with themselves and awaken, and the healing happens naturally. So I don't heal anyone. The healing all comes from within. But what I do is I help people line themselves up so that they can get their body detoxified and nourished in a way that allows them to connect with who they really are.
Wow. Incredible. That statement from her, the moment I realized I didn't need to be healed, I healed, is so profound, because what that implies is she came to understand that the only thing that was leading her to be sick was her own internal mental process of believing and then orienting her life towards being sick.
Exactly.
And that is so hard to wrap our heads around, the understanding that just by instantaneously, fundamentally shifting our belief systems, we can bring about miraculous healing. And that's the challenging part, though, is the instantaneously, fundamentally shifting our belief systems, because they are so entrenched. You know, like, as someone who explores this stuff, I'm having these types of conversations all the time. I still succumb to my limiting belief systems literally all the time. And at least I'm aware of them. But I guess my question is, what would your advice be to help resolve those limiting belief systems?
Yeah. Well, I think that what you just said is so important, is that the spiritual teachings that I study is Toltec, which a lot of people know. Don Miguel Ruiz is, you know, teaches Toltec, is also Don Juan from the Carlos Castaneda books. And in that school of thought, it talk about the Tanal, which is our human, kind of the ego, right? And the Nual is our wholeness. And one of the things that is, I think, important to recognize is that the Tanal will never go away. That, like, limiting, those limiting beliefs. And actually, in some ways, as you start to expand even more, the Tanal will try and hold on even tighter to keep you down. And so this idea that people have that, you know, you become enlightened or where, and you're just always, you don't have the enemies anymore of those thoughts, is just not the case. In some ways, it comes even stronger. And our job is to constantly be stalking ourselves and looking at, okay, what is it that my beliefs are bringing to me? And I love, there's a quote from Lao Tzu in the Tao Te Ching. It says the master uses everything.
Mm.
And so what I teach my clients is that everything that's in front of you, whether that's cancer, whether that's pain, whether that's whatever it is, use it for your growth, to explore what's inside you, what's coming up. My mentor always says, when you squeeze a lemon, you get lemon juice. When you squeeze an orange, you get orange juice. When we get squeezed, if anger comes out, if sadness comes out, it's like, that's what's in there. And that's not a bad thing. That's just showing us what's inside. So when we're squeezed, we can use that information. And I'll just use an example of on Friday, I was flying from LA to Austin. And I was, you know, I got out of the Uber and I knew I had my phone because I was walking between terminals and I was looking at my phone. And then I went and, you know, did my bag check and opened my bag to shove a few things in, and then went through security. And as I was coming out of the security, I heard, check your phone. I look in my purse, my phone's not there. And I was like, oh no. I'm like, I knew I had it, like walking into the terminal, but then I have no idea. And right, with security, you can't just walk back out. You have to like walk out of the airport, the whole thing. So I just remember, I was like, okay, the master uses everything. Like, this is not a mistake. This is not like, I know that it's, and it's funny because it seems like not a big deal to not have your phone, but at the same time, it's big because like everything is in our phone. My partner couldn't get a hold of me, my
and
kids.
You're traveling.
And I was traveling. I was going to another city. Yeah. And So I was just like, okay, how do I use this? And then I was like, okay, we're just gonna stay calm, go out of the airport, retrace your steps. I did all of that. I could not find the phone. And then I was like, okay, what about this is happening for me? Like, what is it that I can use to grow myself in this moment? And I was like, well, it's not very often that nobody can get a hold of me and that I'm just completely untethered. And so I just leaned into that. And I think this is one of the things that we can do, is whatever's in front of us, use it to explore, like, what is it, you know, disconcerting about this? What is it bringing up? What are the things that are opening that I could explore that may be good for me from having this experience? And I think we see our lives through like the things that we want to happen, you know, is good versus the things that we don't want to happen is bad. And if you can just look at them, like they're all here for a higher good, and using that, I think that can help you. And then also recognizing there's no there, there's no destination. And I can say that just from being around so many people at the end of their lives. It's like, it's just the experience. And you never get to some destination. You never finish all the things that you wanted to finish in your life. It's, you know, there's always things that are undone. So it's just, how do we use all of the experiences for us to become more familiar with who we are and what's inside?
And is this a perspective that you came into after that shared death experience?
Yeah.
That's really beautiful. Do you find that when you're helping your clients resolve whatever they're dealing with, as it relates to the emotional component, I know you talked about suppressed emotions, releasing suppressed emotions. That's one of the common things that people are doing. Is it simply that it requires that you be acutely aware of and present with what is currently inside of you and just feel that? And the reason I'm asking this is, I look at people that have chronic depression or chronic anxiety or really any chronic physical condition, and I've sort of come to the perspective that a lot of that is suppressed emotions. But what's particularly, I won't say confusing, but interesting about the mental, psycho-spiritual chronic conditions is that it seems to be they're constantly feeling what is present for them, but they're still suffering, if that makes sense. Like they're dealing with those emotions. And what I've also come to think about that is that maybe they're dealing with chronic anxiety, chronic depression, because they're not really allowing themselves to feel the depth of the anxiety and the depth of the depression. So it's just, there's always just a subtle if not very present amount of anxiety or depression there. So that was kind of a statement instead of a question, but you just pick up on what
I just said. No, but actually you, there are two things in there that I like to speak to. And the first is that, emotions. So one of the techniques that I really like to help people with the emotional piece of healing is something called PSYCH-K, and that's PSYCH and the letter K. And this is a modality that I learned about through Bruce Lipton, because he talks
about it.
Yeah, okay. He used it to really transform his life. And then he talks about it in Biology of Belief. Mm-hmm. But basically, the idea is there are three components to it, but I'll speak to the first component, which is emotional processing. And what you just described is that when people get into emotions, we usually end up dominating with one side of our brain, either the right side, which is you can become kind of overly emotional and kind of lost in it and you know, really feel like you're losing control of the emotion, or going into the left side of the brain, which is more logical and kind of rationalizes and shoves down the emotion. And this is like, we tend to be either one or the other, and we tend to flip-flop. So like, you know, the right brain is typically, we think of more feminine, and the left side is more masculine, but we usually flip. Like sometimes we'll go into emotion and we go into our right brain, and sometimes we go into our left brain, but we don't really fully experience the emotion when we do that. And what Psych-K does is it uses positioning of the body to activate the corpus callosum, which connects both hemispheres of the brain. And when you experience emotions with this whole brain state, both sides of your brain turned on, you experience emotions differently. And emotions are just a wave. So they're just going to come up, they're going to have a crest, and then they're going to come down. But when we're in one side of our brain or the other, we don't ever let that whole thing happen, because we feel like we're going to lose control if we're in the right side of our brain, and we shove it down if we're on the left side of the brain. And so by doing this technique, it teaches people that, oh, I can handle my emotions. I can be with my emotions. And if I allow them to run their course, they're going to come and they're going to neutralize. Mm. And so this is one of the techniques that's very powerful for someone who's experiencing illness, because fear has such a hold, right? That they're so afraid of what might happen and, you know, the treatments and all of those things. And so doing Psych-K is a way to teach people how to experience emotions in a healthy way. And there's some other techniques that you can do as well, but I think part of this is that we have not been taught how to be with our emotions,
yeah.
Right? Most of us are taught to shove it down, or, you know, if you're crying, oh, you're so emotional. And we've gotten all these messages that we haven't really learned how to be with our emotions in a healthy way. Mm. And so what I love about that technique is it teaches them how to be with their emotions in a healthy way and let them run their course, so that they don't have the power that when we don't know how to process our emotions, they have a lot of power over us. But the other piece is that the way that we eat, the way that we connect with our environment, also impact our mental health, right? And so I think some of this is related to the way that we're living, that
absolutely,
we're not able to regulate our emotions because we're eating the wrong kind of foods. We're getting the wrong inputs for our body. We're filled with toxins.
Sitting under studio lights in a house that has Wi-Fi.
I mean, you got it. This is the thing. It's like,
with our Wi-Fi off though. So
yeah. Well, and this is the thing is that you can't, even if you wanted to shut down your Wi-Fi, you've got neighbors all around.
Dirty electricity running through our floors.
Exactly. Yeah. We're surrounded by satellites. Our planet is. So I think it's not to be paranoid about all of these things. It's how do we fortify? How do we understand the environment that we're living in today? And how do we give ourselves the input that make us resilient? And actually, this is a beautiful thing about consciousness, is that when you understand that frequency overcomes all, that if you can raise your frequency, you can become immune to these things, you know, in addition to doing the physical pieces of it. But, you know, there's, I don't think that we can ever get rid of all of the things of a modern world.
And you can become so obsessed to where that's unhealthy.
Well, and I see that actually in my practice.
Yeah, I bet you do. I have a question touching on this emotion thing, because it seems like with the right left brain thing that you're talking about, that really helps you to master your emotions. And I'm thinking of the spiritual teachers. None are coming to the top of my head. Really, Don Juan actually is a really incredible example of this from the Carlos Castaneda books, of being almost so even keeled when it comes to having experiences that the typical human being, especially in modern society, might become emotionally charged over. But being able to take in that exact same experience and process it much more quickly, or not be affected by it, being really impervious to whatever the situation is. And this might seem like an odd question, but how do you know whether you're using these tools like meditation and really like breath work to escape, or if you're using them as or using them as a useful tool to move through the situation that you're presented with that would have previously caused you to become emotionally charged?
That is a very good question.
Yeah.
And I think that it's something that we all have to check ourselves. Like, why am I doing this? Is it that I don't want to experience something? And I don't know that I have an answer for it, because I think
I don't either.
I think this is part of the work, is that for each one of us is, but I do think that we are the biggest liars to ourselves.
Yeah.
Like that we fool ourselves, and we know, you know, what's really happening on a deeper level. And so I think, and this is part of what I think deep healing work is, getting really honest with yourself.
Yeah.
And I think it's not, it's like the opposite of what we've been trained in modern society to show, that everything's perfect and we've got everything figured out. And I think it's much more being honest with yourself about your own messes, you know, and being honest about your past, and then really intentional about your future, and thinking about, okay, you know, one of the practices that my mentor always has us do around our birthday is recapitulation, which is where you spend the month before, like basically the month of your birthday, reflecting back on the past year. Of like, okay, what did I do? What am I proud of that I did? What do I want to take forward? What could I have done better? What do I just like never want to do again? And really being intentional about those things and honest with ourselves, because spirit sees everything, or water sees everything, or whatever it is that's watching sees everything. And we're just fooling ourselves when we, you know, pretend those things aren't there. And so this work is really about uncovering the stuff that we don't want to look at, uncovering the pieces that aren't pretty, and loving all of them. You know, we're beautifully messy, you know, and just embracing that. So, and I think that especially when someone gets sick, you know, cancer or any other illness is a crisis, and crisis in Chinese is symbolized by two symbols. The first is danger, which makes sense, but the second is opportunity.
Wow.
And it's like that crack that illness or any other crisis creates allows us to really look at things in a new way. And if you want to create something different, you have to radically change, you know, and that radical change from where we've been conditioned to live is to, you know, allow it to be messy, allow there to be, you know, some unraveling, and taking a deep look at like, what are those things that we've been hiding from ourselves, or maybe denying ourselves? We knew they were there, but we didn't want to address them. Those are the things that's where the juice is.
Amen. Yeah, it's being willing to look at all the darker aspects of yourself, your shadow, so to speak, but then also being willing to love all and integrate and find the innocence in all the darker aspects of yourself.
Yeah. Well, and I think that it's like seeing ourselves through, like, this was something that just recently came in for me where it's like, talk about, you know, forgetting your past, like the past doesn't exist, right? That's like a very powerful place to live. It's like the only thing that is present is right now. But the problem for me in the now is that I bring all of my experience that I've lived through that is self-critical, limiting, all of those judgments. But like, it's just like a week ago, I was like, well, what if I was like some being and I was just dropped into my body right now? And I had all the experiences, that I had the credentials, I had the things that I had done, but I had no memory of it.
Yeah.
Like I literally just dropped in. How would I use this being, this vehicle for this lifetime? And for me, that is a like a nice experiment, because then I'm like, I'm totally not attached or, you know, looking at myself through a personalized lens, right? It's like no self-importance, because I'm like, oh, I just get to use this like vehicle. And that for me is one of the ways that I try to loosen the grips of my stories of self-importance and like, who cares what I do, you know, like, but right. We have these things like, oh, my mom or my dad's going to say this, or it's like, why does it even matter? You know, like all totally. That stuff that's just BS in our minds.
Yeah. We're just perpetually carrying baggage. But I think it's like, again, going into the shadow of yourself and all related to experience I just had, my wife and I sat for our 8th year wedding anniversary with a friend of ours through a psilocybin couples mm-hmm. ceremony. And the ceremony itself was very personal. It, you know, for me, I'll speak from my experience. It was very beautiful. At first, I was shown my childhood self before any of the trauma that he would endure through childhood trauma. And then for the last half, I was consumed by just darkness. Like all of the things that were done to me, all the things that I've done to other people, all the harm that I've caused other people, all the harm that I've caused myself, all the harm that's been done to me were all personified in just, I was swirling in all of it to the point that I took the eye mask off and I was like putting my hands on the ground. And I was talking to my friend who's a practitioner. And I was like, oh my God. Like I am fundamentally like a piece of shit. I have no business being a dad. I have no business being a husband. Like what is this? And then as I began integrating that, I realized, no, that's not me. These are stories that I'm carrying. And yes, bad things have been done to me. Yes, I've done bad things, but that doesn't mean that that's who I am today. And every day we get to wake up and make choices that reaffirm the person that we want to be. But I think just the act of visiting those darker aspects of yourself and looking at them is healing in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Because I know just being willing to go there, and I've done other experiences of going there. My 15-day water fast was another example of like looking at things that I didn't want to look at, dealing with emotions I didn't want to look at. But just the act of doing that and even being willing to entertain like all the darker aspects of yourself and those thoughts and just looking at them, not suppressing them, that is healing in and of itself. And it was like, I felt so different after that experience, but it was extremely hard because the medicine, especially the way the ceremony was held, forced me to really look at some things. And it was like, oh my goodness. And then you realize after doing it though, it's really not that scary, it's all these stories. You're so afraid to look at it, but just looking at it, just drawing light towards it is what brings about healing.
Absolutely. Well, and it's so humbling. I think the reason why it's so hard for us, it's so hard to see all those aspects, but all of us have that, right? Yeah. All of us have the, you know, the light and the dark and the shadows and all of that. But looking at it is a, you know, it's a privilege and a gift, and also like amazing that you had the courage to do that, right? Because a lot of people just don't want to. But if you can allow it to be there and hold it with compassion, it's so healing. It's beautiful. And just that humility of like, you know, I'm just like anyone else. I'm capable of doing bad things just like anyone else. It keeps us in check to be like, okay, how do I center myself in love and intentionality about how I want to influence my life moving forward?
Yeah, amen. And you know, what's so interesting is my intention for the ceremony, our practitioner had us set an intention, was to come into more self-love. And that's what happened on the back end of that. But I remember being in the midst of the experience. I'm like, this doesn't feel like self-love. And I'm like, no. In order to come into more self-love, you needed to go through all of this because you needed to look at those parts of yourself and learn to love them. And that's exactly what happened.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what unconditional love is, right? Because otherwise I think we're conditionally loving ourselves if we're only seeing the pieces that we want to see of what good we do in the world. But like to really embrace all of it is true love.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, I have some other questions related to cancer specifically, then I want to get into some more consciousness stuff. So this is a big question, and I'll preface this by saying I'm split between two camps, you could say. With respect to what cancer actually is, I don't know if it's that the body packaging up toxins and putting them in one place to sort of preserve the rest of the body so that toxicity doesn't leach into other areas. And then when you get a biopsy, that's inevitably what happens. That actually helps leach toxicity into other areas of the body, possibly, right? So that's one side. Then the other side would say that overwhelmingly, cancer is just an emotional response to the body. And it is a healing response. And German New Medicine would say it's an actual physical adaptation that represents a healing response to an emotional conflict. And I think I kind of lie somewhere in between the two camps. And I don't know where I am. But as someone who studied cancer quite a bit, both in the traditional sense and now in the more holistic, bringing in the importance of the metaphysical aspects of health, where do you land with what cancer actually is?
Well, this is interesting because for the past, your first premise is Tom Cowan's concepts of cancer. And because I mentor with Tom, I have been thinking about this and trying to put it together in my mind with the other things that I know. And the other, so that's the one piece about cancer being toxicity that is being packaged up and compartmentalized to protect the rest of the body. And, you know, his idea is that basically the trash collects and, you know, and then if there's too much in the, let's say the breast, then, you know, it's going to, some of it may end up in the lymphatics and then it could end up in the liver. And then this idea that it cancer, you know, he talks about the, you know, you take a car and you smash up all the car into all these bits and pieces. And then you're like, is this car really like a supercar where it's like dividing and running faster than a regular car? He's like, does that even make sense to you? And so I understand what he's saying there and actually had been thinking really hard about, could this be true? Could cancer not be living cells that are growing and dividing more rapidly, but just an accumulation of debris?
Right. Especially if you think of a reframe of what like a cytopathic effect is in culture. Again, assuming that that represents what happens in the body, but virology as an example tends to think that, oh, that represents viruses growing and replicating when it really could just mean, especially because they're using electron microscopy, that it's the cells breaking down after they've been starved and poisoned. So really this could just be another example of cells breaking down because they're just full of toxicity.
So that, let me say a couple things about that and then the German New Medicine, because I actually think they're the same. So I think that emotional toxins are the same as physical toxins. We just think about them differently. So I actually think that German New Medicine can fit into Tom's concept of you know, cancer being an accumulation of toxicity in the body. So I don't see those two things as separate. But for me, actually, where my questions come up, and this is funny because this weekend I was literally like just laying there thinking about this. I'm like, okay, well, if this is the case, then how do I explain the idea of cancer as a metabolic condition? And the idea of, and let me just explain what that is, and then we'll come back to the idea of cancer being toxins and packaged up. But Otto Warburg is a Nobel Prize winning biochemist and physician who described the Warburg effect, which is basically when you have the production of lactic acid, which is a byproduct of fermentation, in the presence of oxygen. So normal human or, you know, mammalian cells, when oxygen is present, should be using oxidative phosphorylation because we have mitochondria, right? So that's healthy respiration. But cancer, by definition, is not using oxidative phosphorylation, even though oxygen is present. And basically what's happening is that they've switched from using oxidative phosphorylation to fermentation, which is just you use sugar, and it's a much more primitive form of metabolism. And the byproduct is lactic acid. And this is why they talk about with cancer, you have an acidic environment. Part of it is because the cancer itself, the byproduct of the metabolism is lactic acid. Okay. And so what Otto Warburg said was that cancer cell, it is the most consistent hallmark of cancer is this production of lactic acid in the presence of oxygen. So they're using fermentation. And what he postulated was that cancer must be a deficiency or dysfunction of the mitochondria. And we're hearing this also with diabetes and neurodegenerative disease. All these things are related to mitochondrial health, right? But one of the things that I am trying to wrap my head around with Tom's theories and then this idea of cancer as a metabolic condition and that cancer uses fermentation is that in the fermentation hypothesis with cancer using glucose as its only fuel, one of the reasons why you see so much DNA damage in cancer is because of the oxidation that is happening in that fermentation, that the oxygen that's present is actually being used, but it's creating these free radicals. And those free radicals then result in DNA damage. And I know that, like, as a radiation oncologist, the mechanism of damage that radiation does is it creates free radicals that then create DNA damage. And so this idea makes sense to me that if cancer cells are using fermentation and that doing fermentation in the presence of oxygen increases free radicals, that that's the reason why you have all this DNA damage. But what it doesn't make sense to me is how does that fit with Tom's hypothesis of that the cancer cells aren't dividing, mm-hmm. right? If they're not using fermentation, I don't understand how that fits in the metabolic condition with this idea of just toxicity. But what I love about Tom is Tom pushes the boundaries and really makes us think about things that we weren't thinking about before. So I don't know the answer, but this is the stuff that keeps me up at night. It's like, and it's also fascinating because I'm like, you know what? I think we have cancer completely wrong.
Yeah.
And I think when we figure all this out, it'll be so much easier to reverse engineer, you know, how to move out of cancer. And I don't think it's about killing cancer.
No.
It's about balancing the terrain and, you know, really boosting up our healthy cells and our mitochondria so that cancer is, you know, we have cancer in our bodies all the time and our body just takes care of it,
right?
You know, but it's when the balance is shifted and that the body doesn't have the, you know, functioning and the proper nourishment and nutrients to, you know, deal with those cells. And once you get too many, then it's like it overruns and then you've got to, you know, take more aggressive measures to help, you know, restore the balance. But this is a long way of saying, I don't know the answer to your question.
I appreciate that so much. that leads me to my next question though. What are your thoughts on radiation and chemotherapy, especially having been a radiation oncologist for so long?
Yeah. Well, this is interesting because when I first started my practice, this new practice, I thought that I was going to be helping people who were having conventional therapy, but just like get better results. And I didn't know. I just like, that's what I stepped into. And kind of, I just thought that that's what it was going to be. But as I've started to understand cancer more as an imbalance of increased toxicity in the body and lowered immune and like cellular function, when you think about chemotherapy and radiation, and what I see now in my practice is that we already have an imbalance of too much toxicity and lowered immune function when someone gets cancer. Mm-hmm. And if you give chemotherapy and radiation, what do you do to that balance?
You make it
increase right. toxicity with these treatments, and then you lower immune function.
Right.
And so I now have become much more reluctant around traditional therapies. And I want to say that I never supposed to know the right answer for anyone's treatment. Like, I truly believe there's a place for whatever people want to do for their treatment. Like, I really don't have a position. But when people do traditional therapy now, I am much more clear about, okay, you have to understand how these treatments work, and you have to understand that they are increasing toxicity, they are lowering your immune function, and when you finish them, if you don't address the, you know, underlying cause of the cancer and the balance of nourishing your body and detoxifying, you're going to be in the same position and maybe worse. Because this is another thing, is cancer treatments, both chemotherapy, traditional chemotherapy and radiation, kill cancer cells via logarithmic cell kill. And logarithmic cell kill is similar to the way that antibacterials work, where on this is an easy way for people to understand it. You have like an antibacterial and it'll say kills 99.9% of the bacteria. Well, it doesn't say it kills 100% because it kills them down to like a low number, but doesn't get rid of every mm-hmm. last cell or every last bacteria. With cancer treatments, it's the same, but we were always taught, well, it's fine because the body takes care of cancer cells. So if we get it down to this low number, then the body's immune system will take care of them. But if we've now lowered the immune, first of all, if someone has cancer, their immune system's not functioning properly because they've allowed the cancer to grow. And now you're going to lower it, even though you have less cells. You know, on a scan, it's like a million cells is 1 centimeter of cancer. And like for a PET scan to see it on a PET scan, it's a million cells. You could have treatment and leave 100,000 cells, 500,000 cells, and not see it on the scans. And the idea is the body's going to take care of it. But the truth is, if you don't have a functioning immune system, can the body really do that? Mm. And so I'm just really cautious about telling people, if you're going to have traditional therapy, you want to make sure that you have a plan for looking at what are the things that may have contributed to this in your lifestyle, and shifting those things afterwards, but then also really boosting the immune system and making sure we get the mitochondria functioning and basically people's bodies functioning in a holistic way through, you know, all the practices.
One more question I do have related to chemo and radiation, before we get into some of the other topics related to consciousness, is how often... And it's okay if you don't have actual statistics on this, but how often is cancer truly put into remission forever, and how, you know, and it doesn't come back after having chemo or radiation?
So it really depends on the type of cancer, the stage of disease, the type of chemo and radiation. But I'll just give an example with breast cancer of... since that was my expertise, is breast cancer. Early stage breast cancer, stage one, should have like a 95%+ remission rate. Like, so you should, you know, 5-year survival and recurrence rates should be above 95% for a woman with a stage one breast cancer. But what's interesting is that there's data that shows that, you know, and these numbers vary, but that 30% of women at some point will have then it pop up elsewhere, you know, like in the lymph nodes or in another organ, which never made sense to me and actually doesn't fit with the data that we're given. But then you see this in some of the other...
Does it make sense to you now, though?
it makes sense to me now because I think we're missing the problem. Right. We're just taking
That's
out
the
garbage,
yeah.
right?
Yeah,
and
like,
then, but we're like, we didn't know where did the garbage
house.
Come from, right? Yeah, so it makes sense to me. But the other thing is this, is that, and I find this the most frustrating, actually, after leaving, is that finding actual data that is meaningful is challenging.
Mm.
And that,
which is so interesting with how much money has been poured into cancer research over the last God knows how many years.
Yeah. And specifically, it's like incidence. Like, because one of the things that I really was interested in as I stepped into this work is like, it seems to me like the incidence of cancer is increasing. It seems to me that the people are getting younger and younger. But when you look at the data, it's not that clear, right? Mm-hmm. And then I don't know if it's suppressed. I don't know, but I will say that it is hard to get clear stats on like what cancer rates were 100 years ago, 50 years ago, and now, and just getting clean numbers.
Yeah.
You know, that for me, I find challenging. But what I would say is that I don't think that we are as successful as we say we are in cancer therapies. And I think it's because we're missing the, you know, what's actually happening. And it makes sense to me now. But yeah.
What's that one book? I think it's called, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. Have you ever read that or heard of that book?
I haven't read that.
Okay. I haven't either, but from what I understand about the book, and I could be totally wrong, or maybe someone made up their own version or, their own implications of what the book's trying to relay, but it's that zebras in the wild don't get ulcers, but zebras that are in the zoo get ulcers. And I just look at animals in the wild, obviously the wild, especially for wild animals, it's like, you know, literally chaos. I'm not going to say it's like all perfect. I don't know if you've seen the account, Nature is Metal on Instagram, showing exactly what happens in nature. And it's horrible. Like the things that animals, predators will do to the young of their prey. It's horrible. But the point is that there's still some symbiotic fashion that nature lives in that we just cannot possibly understand, where animals do, if they survive some of those earlier killings or, you know, being mauled by another animal, tend to live longer, healthier lives than they do in captivity. And I just kind of relate that to what it's like for us in modernity versus how human beings traditionally live. And when it comes to virtually all diseases, I think it's just a function of how we're living in totality that is leading to the, you know, these diseases and their exponential rise, especially with things like cancer. And I think it's a fallacy to think that one single thing is the cause of another single thing. But that's what is oftentimes claimed by the mainstream medical establishment when it comes to any of these given diseases. And oftentimes they become so hyper-focused on either a totally unproven paradigm, thinking that that is the true cause, or something that is totally disproven to be the cause, and they put all of their funding and resources towards that, and then completely ignore the spectrum of other things that is very clearly causing health issues across the board. And before you respond to that, I just wanted to read this, and I read this, I think, on episode 97 with Dean Hall, who reversed cancer twice by just immersing himself in nature, what he calls forest bathing, which is hilarious that we even have to have a like term for that, literally just going out in nature, you know. But the 5-year survival rate for patients increased from 63% in 2000 to 68% in 2015. The overall cancer survival rate was 49% in the mid-1970s and is currently at 68%. So, I mean, that's good. The American Cancer Society also estimates that 3.8 million cancer deaths have been averted over the past 30 years. I'd love to see where they can put that number. But what's interesting is the number of cancer cases annually rose from 1.3 to 1.8 million, growing consistently nearly every year, which represents an increase of 36.5%. The number of cancer deaths grew from approximately 550,000 to just under 600,000, which represents an increase of 8.4%. So cancer survival rates, according to these statistics, seem to be increasing, but incidence of cancer are growing exponentially. And likewise, because the incidence of cancer are growing exponentially, so are cancer deaths, despite overall across the board survival rates being much higher than they were previously. So it's just so interesting, as we're pouring so much money into cancer research, yes, cancer survival rates seem to be going up, but cancer rates themselves are growing exponentially, and mainstream medicine can't seem to figure out what the cause is or what are the issues. And it's like, for people like you and me, I think we don't highlight any individual specific cause, but we can at least look at, here's some very clear things that we're ignoring across the board that need to be factored in to what is causing this phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the first part, I didn't read that book, so I don't want to like misspeak on that book.
I didn't
book.
Either, though, so I could be
so I'm like,
wrong.
I don't know. But the one thing that I do know is like animals don't get cancer, you know, in the wild,
right.
But our domesticated
right.
animals do. And they're, think about it, they're living a modern lifestyle in houses, not connected to the earth, maybe not getting sunlight, you know, so they're having the same lack of inputs that
right.
we are. And so to me, that makes sense. Like, okay, we're taking natural animals, humans, you know, other animals, and putting them into an environment that they weren't designed for, and they get sick, right? So that makes sense to me, even though I haven't read the book, so I don't know why zebras don't get ulcers, but it makes sense that in captivity, that is
I
not...
I shouldn't have even brought up that book, because, like, I've not read it either, so I could be completely wrong. But as I understand it, or as it was explained to me, I'm like, oh yeah, that makes sense. I should probably read that book. I'm sure I ordered it, and then Kylie, my wife, is like, why'd you order another book that's sitting on our shelf? And...
That's so funny.
Sorry. Okay.
No. So that's perfect. So, and then the second piece. So if you think about this, like, this is the narrative that they want you to hear, is that survival rates are increasing, cancer deaths are, you know, they'll say they're down because the overall population is up. So even though those numbers
right.
are slightly higher, the population's gone up. So then the actual incident or like, you know, death rate is maybe slightly lower. And these are the things that they want to show to say we're doing such a good job. But
mm-hmm.
you pointed out the exact piece, and that's why I'm so focused on the incident rates. Like, are we really getting accurate incident rates? Because this is what we're seeing, is that it's skyrocketing.
Yeah.
And this is what they're not talking about. Like, we did not hear anything about that,
right.
about, you know, cancer incidence is rising and what are we doing wrong? It's all focused on, and it's hyper-specialized, you know, and in medicine, it's not, this is the one thing that, with the system of Western medicine, it works exactly as it was designed. It's not a mistake.
Right.
All of it is designed.
Was that hard for you to wake up to?
It's so humbling because, you know, for 20 years, I would have considered myself an expert in breast cancer. And then to be like, I didn't even know what was going on. Like,
mm-hmm.
I had no idea. And
did
that,
you think you did, though?
At the time when I was practicing, I just was like, well, this is what we say. But
right.
the one thing that I will say is that there was a piece of me that hated the studies, that hated the algorithms. Like, there was a part of medicine that I really didn't like. And I thought
right.
it was the science. Like, I thought maybe I'm just not scientifically minded, that I really went into medicine from a humanitarian perspective of, like, I was a neuroscience and biopsychology major as an undergrad. And I was like, okay, what am I going to do with this? And I was like, well, I could go to medicine, you go into medical school, or I could be a researcher, not realizing that I could have done anything with an undergraduate degree, right? But so I was like, well, I don't know. And my mom was like, I don't think you want to be a doctor, because she was a nurse practitioner. And she just was like, I don't know that you want that lifestyle. And so I was like, well, what is the one thing that I would hate about medicine? And I was like, well, I don't think I could handle being around people dying. So I went and volunteered for hospice when I was 20 to basically cross medicine off my list.
Mm.
And spending time around people who were dying completely changed my perspective on life, because
wow.
here I was spending time with these people as a volunteer. Like I didn't have any authority or anything. And they were telling me things about life that I had never learned, like what was important, what they would have done differently, what they wish they had done more of. And I was just sold. And I was like, I don't care what I do in my life, but I want to spend time around that. And that's actually, I went into medical school specifically wanting to go into oncology because of that experience, not because of the science. But what was so interesting is, and this, I now see this interaction very differently than I did at the time. But when I applied to medical school, I had an interview. So, you know, I probably interviewed at maybe like, I don't know, 6 or 8 medical schools. And at none of the schools did they have me interview with an oncologist, even though I had said I wanted to be an oncologist, just however the interviews lined up. I was never with an oncologist. But when I interviewed at Harvard, they put me with a pediatric oncologist, and I was so excited to meet this man. And he was the first oncologist that I was going to meet because I actually hadn't spent time around oncologists. And I was so excited to meet him. And he said, you know, I see here on your personal statement that you want to be an oncologist and tell me why. And so I told him, I said, I spent this time around people who are dying and the intimacy and the connection and the things that they shared with me and the things that I was learning about life were just incredible. And I was like, I want to be around that for the rest of my life. And he looked at me and he said, that is not a good reason to become an oncologist. He's like, you could be a nurse, you could be, you know, a therapist, you could do all kinds of things. But if you want to become an oncologist, you need to love the science. Oh, it was funny because it crushed me. Like, I really thought he was saying I wasn't smart enough. Obviously, I was smart enough because I was interviewing at Harvard. But I was like, I took this as like, oh, my gosh, my reason for going into medicine is wrong or bad or something. And I left that, you know, interview just crying and never told anyone after that why I wanted to go into oncology. But so I see it now that that inkling that I had about the science is that the science was off and it was my higher self telling me, you know what I'm saying? But we don't know what to do with that at the time. So my whole career, I just always thought I didn't like the science. Like I did it because I loved my patients.
Because the science was off and didn't make sense.
Yes. So anyway, but I think that's what, you know, with these numbers that are put out, it's to tell a specific narrative that feeds the system.
Yeah. Well, it also seems very, it's like a very machinistic way of looking at life and the body in just in terms of data, especially when it comes to data that is very easily manipulated and data that is coming from people with glaring conflicts of interest that don't want you to see other sides of the data that might indicate things to go against what they're offering. And I mean, that's a perfect segue into what I wanted to talk about next with consciousness as it relates to cancer. And I already know we've touched on it a little bit, but I think this is something that Western medicine and really even a lot of alternative approaches to health at this point, like so-called holistic and natural versions of health, are still missing the mark on, in my opinion, is that metaphysical piece that we were talking about earlier. So as you started to wake up to the emotional, psycho-spiritual implications of cancer and other diseases, did you approach any of your former colleagues and talk with them about that and sort of, you know, drop some lines to them to see if they would bite?
No, but I think so.
Did you just like abruptly leave?
Yeah, I just basically, so my shared death experience happened in the fall of 2020. I took a whole year to like really sit with it and was doing my own research. And then finally in December of 2021, told my husband, I said, I know that you're not supportive of this, but I have to do it. And so when I made that decision, then I told my chief, and basically, you know, it takes a long time to recruit for specialists like myself, and I didn't want to leave them, you know, short staffed. So I said that I would stay until they could find someone else. And basically, my chief was super supportive. She's like, what do you need? She's like, you don't want to practice radiation oncology? What can I do? Like, how can we create another position for you? We can't lose you, because I had been a very valuable physician leader for them and had basically designed their cancer service line. And so she was like, she saw the potential in me. But then, of course, like, as we're creating a business case and whatever, they're like, what is this? Like, what exactly, you know, are you wanting to do? And then it came down to, they're like, does a doctor really need to do this? If it's not really like giving chemo or radiation, couldn't a cancer counselor or something design this program? And I was just like, okay, this is just exactly why I need to leave. And so ended up leaving in July of 2022. And what I would say is that I think my colleagues have no idea.
Yeah.
And I think that I don't even try to explain it to them, because I think that, I mean, what I explain to them is, you know, the idea of integrative care and holistic approach of, you know, the mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual, but not really talking about it in a meaningful way, because I don't know that they would understand it. Do you know? And yeah. So
like more conceptual than actual, like, no, this is how reality works.
Yeah. And so for me, that's like with my podcast, on my podcast, I share my story of why I left Western medicine. And then I talk a little bit about this, and I talk about the learnings that I'm coming to and bring guests on to teach those things, so that hopefully if they're interested, they can come along. But I also feel like it's not my job to make anyone else see the world the way that I see it. Mm-hmm. And so I am very open and, you know, I'll share with anyone, but I definitely don't go out there and in a conventional space start saying these things that might trigger them.
Yeah. How many other on-call, actually, let's just say MDs in general, let's say medical professionals in general, how many other medical professionals would you say know at some level something is severely, fundamentally wrong with Western medicine, but because they look to their left and their right and they see other people just continuing to toe the line, they decide to continue doing that as well?
A lot. So this morning, I'm, you know, still in a lot of Facebook groups for doctors. And so I happen to open Facebook, and the first post that I see is just this doctor. She's like, I'm tired. I'm, you know, exhausted from giving everything that I have, and the denials to get my patients the things that they need, and it was just like on and on. And then there's just like 100+ comments of other female doctors saying, I get it, I'm right there with you. And this is why the suicide rates for doctors are among the highest of any professionals. Wow. It actually, this is like a secret that is not told, is that doctors have one of the highest rates of suicide. And I actually know that if I didn't have the conviction that I did to leave medicine because of the experience that I've spent so much time around death, that after I had that shared death experience, I know what people say when they face their death. And I knew that if I didn't follow what was true to me, that at the end of my life, I would regret that. Mm. But I don't know, if I didn't have that and I had this knowing, and then my husband wasn't supportive and I felt trapped, I can see how people take their lives.
Yeah.
Because they just feel trapped. And so I think there are so many doctors who know something is wrong. But, you know, I was like, my husband didn't support, but I was like, okay, well, I'm like, how do I sell enough to create a nest egg to start over again? Mm-hmm. But I think most people don't have the courage, you know, to do something like that, because they're like, what am I? And it doesn't make sense. Like, from a logical perspective, it's like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. You're throwing away like a beautiful life for what? And I think that a lot of doctors are in that position. It's like, how could I throw all of this away? They right. just don't have a path.
Especially with also like how much debt they have. Like that's got to be a huge factor too.
Yeah.
And then they sort of created an identity around what they've learned, especially as they've gone on, if they've been practicing for some time, which I commend you. You were practicing for 20 something years, and now here you are fully admitting, yeah, most of the things that I learned were completely wrong, and sort of rebranding yourself in a way where you're in pursuit of what is true. And that's so rare, but it's also so cool because you are an example for other people, for other professionals. And we need more people like you who are willing to do that and speak out in order to sort of shift this paradigm towards true health.
Well, I think it's important for us who've been inside, because we really understand how the system works, that as we come out, there's power in that. And I do hope that more doctors have the courage to say this is not working, but a lot of them are becoming life coaches or starting to practice in different ways, but not coming out and saying it's totally broken, do you know? And I think that there's going to be, it's coming. The system's, you know, it's cracking. It'll just be interesting to see how that happens. I don't know how it'll happen, but, you know, I do hope that there are more of me that come out and say, this is not the way.
There's been more and more lately, honestly. Yeah. Like it's pretty amazing because I get a lot of messages, but more frequently over the last year, I've received messages from MDs and DOs who are like, hey, I came across your work. I thought you were batshit crazy. Like, hey, there's some good things that you're saying now, and I'm really interested. Or some other people, MDs messaging me like, hey, I've been following you and Dr. Cowan and Dr. Andy Kaufman and the Baileys for the last 4 years, and it really makes sense to me, and I'm a medical professional. It's really cool. So there is a lot more lately, happening, which is great. Yeah, it totally is happening. So I want to, we touched on it briefly earlier, but I want to talk about your conscious oncology approach in more detail. So you have come to understand the problems with the traditional approach for cancer. You're reconciling with the reality that emotions and spiritual health play a huge role in the expression of our health. So what are you doing with your conscious oncology approach?
Yeah. So the reason why I call it conscious oncology is that the foundation of it is in consciousness. But the pillars of my practice are water. So getting your water right, both the water that we drink and also the water that we are bodies of water, diet and supplementation, physical practices, which include like grounding, sunlight, sauna, detoxification, emotional work, mental work, and then spiritual work. And the idea is to help balance the body through detoxification and then nourishment with the right inputs to line it up to allow the body to do what it does naturally, which is heal, right? So and we think about this, like we don't ever think about when you cut your finger about it healing, right? But a diabetic does. So if a diabetic cuts their hand, they know that it's not going to heal because they've got too much sugar in their blood. The sugar is impeding that healing. Well, we have the same thing going on. This is why we can't heal cancer ourselves, because our bodies are inflamed. Sometimes it's sugar, but it's a whole bunch of other things. And so what I do is I work with people to look at what are the toxins that they've been exposed to and they've experienced, and how do we clean them out to get them functioning at their highest level so that the body can heal. And then also, you know, all healing is spiritual. So our body is sending signals to us through about things that need to be healed on a deeper level. And so the cancer, you know, we've been told the cancer is the problem, right? This entity, this is the problem, this should what we should be attacking. But the truth is these are just messages. These are, you know, just information that our body is providing that things are out of balance. Right. And it's an invitation. I really see illness as an invitation to change your life.
Yeah. It's like, hey, Alec, pay attention to me now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And cancer is like a big pay attention now. Yeah. Like you've probably missed the little, like, yeah.
That's a backhand slap. Like, hey, wake up.
Yeah. But like, and I know this just from my, you know, I was misaligned in my career, and those little like messages I was ignoring because it didn't make sense and I didn't have support. And I was like, I don't know what to do with this information. And then it's like, you know, bam, you know, I was hit. And then I was like, okay, I have to pay attention now. And I think cancer is one of those events for people. It's like, okay, if you're not going to pay attention now, you know, when?
What I love about what you're doing is it seems that you are taking the two, I won't say different approaches, because I do think that they're complementary in the emotional aspect of cancer and the German New Medicine-esque approach to what cancer is. And then the package of toxins. And again, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. Mm. I agree that there is some sort of middle ground there, or a combination of the two situation. Anyway, it seems as if you're incorporating both in the way that you approach practicing now.
Yeah. Well, and it all comes down to the water.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about the water, if we're beings of water, 99.9% of our molecules are water, the state of the water that we hold is either life-giving or, you know, basically dysfunctional. And so all of those things affect our water. Our nutrition affects our water. The water that we drink affects our water. The physical practices, you know, sunlight is structuring our water. Grounding is structuring our water. Emotions, toxic emotions, disrupt our water, right? Consciousness, the thoughts that we hold. So it actually is all the same, but the toxins fall into these different categories of either physical toxins, emotional toxins, mental toxins, or spiritual toxins of like taking on a life that's not authentic to you. You know, all of these things affect the water that we are. And by clearing that out, I think it's all the same. You know, it's just, it's how do we get ourselves clear so that we are, you know, the life force within us is vital and, you know, expressing itself at its fullest.
Beautifully said. You know, what's so crazy is I wrote this down as a note to ask you, since our bodies are likely lined with fourth phase water, I know you're obsessed with water like I am. Are you a water sign, by the way?
I'm a fire sign. I'm
okay,
Aries. A
fire sign. So I have two water signs in me. I'm also very emotional. So, but I'm like obsessed with water. So fourth phase water, it's likely that that is the water that our cells are comprised of, right? And per the work of Gerald Pollack, Gilbert Ling, Veda Austin, Masaru Emoto, and others, we know that fourth phase water especially is able to transmit and receive and store information, reflect back reality, et cetera, et cetera. So I've thought about what you just said. You said so brilliantly is that disease is purely various ways that the water in our bodies is being denatured, essentially. Correct. That's what disease is. And again, just like you said, it could be physical, it could be metaphysical, or a combination of the two. And that's literally what disease is. It's just denaturing the water in our bodies.
Exactly. Yeah. And when I found Tom Cowan, that's how I found Tom is, and actually what's interesting is not even through cancer. He has the book, Cancer and the New Biology of Water. And as an oncologist, you would have thought that was the book I read
first.
That's
what I would have assumed.
But it's not. Actually, it's really serendipitous the way I ended up coming into learning about water. But so, I saw Tom on, I think it was like Wise Traditions, their like annual conference or something. And like, what doesn't make you sick? Tom gave a keynote or something. I was like, oh, that's like really interesting. And I was like,
Have you ever heard any of the virology stuff before?
I'd never heard him before.
Boy.
And I was like, wow, this guy is like really out there. But the thing is, this is that since that event, I used to just consume information. So whatever was put in front of me, I would consume as a voracious reader. But since my event, now I just tune. And if something resonates, then I go and then I want to learn more.
Love
and so
it.
Tom really resonated with me. And so I went onto his website and then I saw the book, Cosmic Heart, Human Heart. And somewhere on there, it said, the heart is not a pump. And I had like, 6 months before I came across this, I had started dating someone who was a former professional cyclist, and he had been racing up until he was 50 as a professional cyclist and also as an amateur. And when he turned 50, he had just won like the state championship in Georgia for pro 1-2, but then also masters. And his cardiologist or his primary doctor had said, you know, something's off on your EKG. I think you should see a cardiologist. And so he had just won these races. He's training normally. He goes in and the person who does his echocardiogram, just the technician turns completely white, walks out of the room. And the doctor comes in and is like, you're in heart failure. You're never getting on a bike again. You know, your ejection fraction is 15%. And as a doctor, I know that an ejection fraction of 15% means someone could barely walk to the front door, let alone to their mailbox. So how is someone who is racing a bike professionally winning a race with an ejection fraction of 15%? I was just like, this made no sense to me. Yeah. So reading that book really helped me start to understand, oh, the heart's not a pump, that actually it's the easy water that's facilitating the circulation. And so that's actually what got me into the work of Gerald Pollack and then looking at Tom's work around cancer and diminishment of easy water. But what's interesting is my mentor ever since like I had started working with him, he had been speaking about water, but he works in the ancient ways and all of his teachings are coded. And so he doesn't ever come out and say it. Like I have to perceive what he's trying to share with me. And he'd been talking about water and water and water and water and osmosis and water. And I was just like, I hear you, but I'm like, is this water that they're drinking? Like, I was like, what kind of water? I literally was so confused for so long. And it was like when I read Tom's book and started reading Gerald Pollack's work and then looking at Van Austin and Emoto, I was like, oh my gosh, it finally makes sense. And how water is the source of life, you know? Yeah. And that's one thing that my mentor has always said, that the one practice that you can do that's the most powerful if you don't do anything else, bless the water. Mm. Every time you come in contact with water, bless the water. And, you know, so water has been a very important part of my spiritual practices, but it wasn't until I came across Tom and then Gerald that it all started to make sense for me from a spiritual perspective, how all of this fits together, and then how beautiful that healing is all related to our water.
Oh, that's so amazing. Because I've also been obsessed with water, especially as it relates to the nature of reality and consciousness and all of it, health, just life in general. Yeah, that's incredible. Since we're on the topic of water, let's talk now about the role of water as the connecting factor in mind-body medicine.
When I came across the work of Gerald Pollack and started to really understand easy water, it started to make sense to me why in healing we don't just need physical practices, but we need mental, emotional, and spiritual practices, because all of them influence our water. So that water is like the science that explains why you need all these different inputs, right? And I think that this is one thing that initially when I discovered, you know, put this together for myself, I just started talking about it. And I was like talking about my podcast. And I'm like, it's water. It's the water that you are. It's the connecting science that explains all this. And I was like crickets. People are like, what is she talking about? So what's interesting is I talk less about it and more use it to inform the way that I help people understand
their
body.
I get what you mean,
heal.
Right? Like you get what is going on at a water level as it pertains to our bodies, physically and metaphysically. So you design your approach to health around how it impacts our water without communicating that it's impacting our water.
Correct.
Our bodies of water, if you will.
Yeah. And I do talk about it with my clients, but not, it's not important for them to necessarily understand it to implement the practices that will help their water. Right. And then the other thing is that, and this is something that I really have seen is true, is that especially with people who are dealing with illness like cancer, is they're quite inflamed, most of them. To get to the point where you have cancer, they're inflamed for various reasons, from the foods that they're eating, the toxins in their environment, the thoughts that they're having, the emotions. And one of the things that I've realized is that it's not important for them to understand water is this, you know, science behind healing, or consciousness is the foundation of healing, because they almost can't perceive it when they're so inflamed. And so part of what I'm doing is helping just lay the foundation so that they can clean themselves out, because as they clean themselves out, their antenna tunes and gets clearer. So then they can understand these deeper concepts. And I also realized that for me, I just jumped into all of this head first, because I was just like, oh my gosh, I saw what wasn't true. And I was just like, I just was, you know, consuming all of this and very much open, mm-hmm. but not everyone is there.
Right.
And so helping people, the way that I help them get there is by cleaning themselves out and doing some of these practices. And then eventually people start to see, oh, okay. And then can grasp the spiritual concept of like, what is this cancer trying to teach me, mm-hmm. and accessing higher levels of consciousness. But you need to lay some foundation for that.
Right. And I would imagine with cancer, especially, there's a lot of fear to overcome there too, because just a cancer diagnosis itself for many people invokes so much fear and anxiety and uncertainty that I would imagine can be extremely overwhelming. So yeah, I'd just love to touch on fear as it relates to consciousness, as it relates to health, as it relates to cancer, water, all of it.
It's not an accident in this society, you know, with the powers that be, that fear is projected, that, you know, anger, all of these things, the negative emotions actually are a way to keep us disconnected from our true selves. And so you're absolutely right that cancer brings up the biggest fears. Like, this is many people's biggest fear, to get cancer, and then they have it, and then they're like, see, now I do have something to be afraid of, right? So it's like, and it can reinforce itself.
Right.
And this is the biggest thing is, and Don Juan talks about that fear is the number one enemy. And it's true. And so this is why part of the work that I do with people is not only helping them deal with past trauma that they may have trapped in their body, but helping them become fluent with their emotions so that they don't get trapped in the fear, right? So that we can help you move through. And it's okay. Like, I think this is the thing, is like, you can have an awareness that healing is possible, and, you know, through higher levels of consciousness and all of that, and it still be really freaking hard.
Right.
Like, the experience is not easy, and managing yourself through that, you need tools to be able to deal with the fear and manage your emotions and not suppress them, to be able to, you know, become fluid enough. Like, the way that I think about it is that, and it's like, comes back to the water, but that we are best when we are flowing like a river. And what fear does is it freezes us like an iceberg. Mm-hmm. And when you're frozen, it's like nothing moves, nothing, you know, is able to heal. And
quite
so
literally, and then toxicity builds up. It's like putting a dam or putting a tree across a river. And then all that stuff just builds up and it becomes mucky and swampy. Likewise, that's what happens in our body, which is why it's important to feel the emotions, mm-hmm. move through them, because then the dam opens up. And then you might deal with some very challenging at first detoxification symptoms, because that's all that finally starting to flood out of you. And then you're coming back into homeostasis, essentially.
Exactly. So I think that the idea of fear as being a big thing to address with cancer, you're 100% spot on. Mm-hmm. It's one of the biggest things that I work on with people, is how do we move past that, you know, and also that our higher self, so that idea of like in society that for fear has been projected because it keeps us asleep, that the fear blocks the connection with our higher self that's pure love. And so this is not an accident, right? But this is our job, is to recognize that when we hold those contracted emotions, it also limits our connection with our higher selves.
Yeah. Amen. For people who have cancer, or, you know, stories of people who had loved ones who tried these non-Western medicine approaches to cancer and still ended up passing away, unfortunately, or, you know, even, of course, those who did do the Western medicine approach and passed away, what are some of the ways that, especially now with your experience of the, you know, the shared death experiences, working with people in hospice and hearing what they said as they were on their deathbed. And I think it goes without saying at this point, you understanding that this is not who we truly are and there's something much greater than us and that we exist forever. With that as the context, for those whose cancer is really overcoming them, and it's pretty clear that they may end up passing away, how can you still help facilitate emotional and you know, mental and spiritual healing as they're in their death process with cancer?
Yeah, so it's a good question. And what's interesting is I think this is our human interpretation of success is not dying of the cancer, but healing the cancer. But the truth is that we have no idea what anyone's life path is programmed for, right? And so someone may, their plan may be to transition from that illness. But what we're really here for is to learn and grow on a spiritual level and to take more knowing and remembering an understanding of who we truly are before we leave. Mm. And actually, what's so beautiful is that when people get close to their own death, things open and that beautiful healing happens even when people transition, you know, having cancer. And that's one of the things that my mentor talks to me about is that, number one, it's never too late to heal. So even when someone looks like they're ready to transition, it could happen at any time. Someone could
like
spontaneously heal, like Anita Morjani.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that even if the body is not going to heal, how can you help them know themselves better? How can you help them see the lesson that was meant for them in this? And actually, like, I love working with people who are, you know, given terminal diagnoses because, number one, I don't believe in it. Number one, I don't think that that's true. But two, there's so much potential for healing. And actually, the people whose back are up against the wall are the ones who are the most likely to have these transformative healing experiences than someone who has, you know, like an early stage disease and they think they're going to be okay. They just got to do some couple things. Like when your back is against the wall, you can make radical shifts. And it's kind of like the water fast, you know, it's an extreme experience that gives us these openings, and being close to death is an opening, you know? And so I think that, you know, my understanding of why we're here is that we come in and we forget who we are, right? We're one with God. We're all, a manifestation of God coming to experience itself. But we forget all of that when we come in, and we're conditioned out of it as well. And our job is, even with the blindfolds on, is to remember, you know? And so the healing is remembering, you know, and Anita Morjani talks about that remission in cancer is remembering your mission, why you came.
Wow.
And actually, that's one of the things that I've seen. So my practice is relatively new, and many of my patients have had like surgery or whatever, where it's hard to tell, like, what is the result of what we're doing together versus the results of like whatever treatment they've had. But I had one client who, she ended up having her cancer spread to her brain. That's when I started working with her. And she had something called radiosurgery, which is just very high dose radiation into the brain. And with radiosurgery, you expect the tumor to get slightly bigger at 3 months after the radiation, and then it'll start to shrink, but it never goes away. And it would still be there. It's just like, you know, basically considered dead tissue. And so she started working with me. She had the radiosurgery, but we did, you know, all of this work, and including a prolonged water fast for 17 days.
Wow.
And with her water fast, I could see it happening with her. She was starting to open. She had already done a lot of the like foundational work, but I was seeing it open. And then when she finally finished this, and we planned on doing 17 days just because she had to travel. And so that was the planned stop date. When she hit that 17th day, it was like someone else emerged, and she was so powerful. And she told me, she said, I knew all along that I was not going to, cancer wasn't going to be the end for me. She said, but now I know. She says, it's gone. And she said, and also, you know what? I know why I'm here. I'm supposed to do mindset coaching. And she'd been doing like a different business completely. And it was just so powerful that I was like, I know that that's true. I know that her cancer is gone. But it wasn't until a couple months later that she had her scan and she went to see the neurosurgeon. And he was like, the tumor's gone. And she was like, yeah, isn't it supposed to be gone? And he's like, well, yeah, but not really. Do you know what I'm saying? And he couldn't really explain to her.
Like, it was supposed to just be dead tissue in there, but now it's literally the tumor is gone and all the growth there is gone.
Yeah. So yeah. She wasn't sure like what that meant. She knew it was good, but then It wasn't until she's like, she got me the scans and basically what you can see is that the tumor is completely gone. There's just an empty space where the tumor was before. There's no necrosis, no dead tissue, no nothing. And at 3 months after radiosurgery, that's just not anywhere on the spectrum of what you would expect to happen.
Wow.
Like, I've never seen a result like that. And so this for me is proof that this can happen. You know, and I saw it. And also the other thing is that I tie this back to Anita's work is because when it happened, she also knew why she was here.
Incredible. Just the instantaneous knowing.
And it was like that. And so it's like, and also she had gotten like a download about a whole mindset program like a year before, and she had written it down. She's like, I don't know exactly what I'm supposed to do with this, but then it was just all clear. And so this is one of the things is that the remembering is healing, but it's also like remembering why we're here, and it's all connected, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think of, yeah, of course I want to help you heal your cancer, but I also know that if that doesn't happen, there's total potential for miraculous healing in other ways that will reintegrate you back in with more than what you came with.
Right. You're healing the essence of you, which goes far beyond healing cancer in the physical body anyway.
Right. Well, and this is just like a drop in the bucket for your existence.
Exactly. And the ironic thing about that though is oftentimes healing the essence of who you are, sometimes like in some of these cases, the one you just mentioned, inevitably heals the physicality of who you are too. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, not all the time, but again, we don't know exactly the way this whole canvas is painted. This whole dance is orchestrated. So we have no idea what someone else's path is. Like that healing that they facilitated in the metaphysical aspects of who they are, despite passing away of cancer, may be exactly what they needed for wherever they go afterwards, whatever life they come into, if that happens, I don't know. But wow, that is such a beautiful, beautiful story. Do you oftentimes use water fasts with the clients that you work with?
So I do. It's not always possible because some people are doing conventional therapies and then I won't do that. And then also you need to take people off their medications. So, but yes, water fasting is, I really believe, one of the most powerful ways to reset the body. And also what's beautiful about it is that when you go into water fasting and into autophagy, the body preferentially kills the cells that are weaker. And I'm I'm not going according to Tom's theory, right? So I'm like, I'm talking about cells, but you know what I'm saying. So basically, it goes after.
We got to use language that relates to someone. Like,
exactly.
What else can
the
we say?
weaker parts of the body are what are autophagized first, right? So it's a very powerful way to get rid of those cells. And I didn't know that you could water fast for that long. When my mentor, he brought it up to me in the fall, he said, you know, a water fast for 30 days would heal cancer. And I was like, 30 days, what? Mm-hmm. And so then the next day I was like, okay, well, I'm going to see how long I can go, which I would not recommend. So if you're going to do a water fast, and you know this, but you have to rest, actually, 100%. You can't just like,
you can't work. So I will say, a good friend of mine, I was playing pickup basketball yesterday, and he's on day 4 of a water fast playing basketball. But he also played professionally in Australia. So playing with the rest of us, he was like going half speed and still playing, but still fourth day of a water fast.
I learned that the hard way. I did 6 days working and it was really not a good idea. So if I do it again, I would really rest. And Lauren Lockman, who runs the biggest water fasting facility in the world, I interviewed him, and he doesn't let people do anything. Mm-hmm. They literally are just like laying, you know, not even scrolling on social media or anything. So,
I think the importance of that is, because I've interviewed Lauren as well, and I've thought along about the reasons for that. Obviously, yes, so that you're conserving energy, so that your body can use that energy to detoxify, especially since it's not having to digest things anymore. But I think whether Lauren realizes this or not, in my own experience, especially doing one for 15 days, so I can't imagine what it'd be like with 30, but is that when you sit, you have to just be present with yourself and what is inside of you. And that is a huge component of healing. Oh. And I think that whether Lauren realizes it or not, is so profound, because just having to sit and be there means that you have to deal with all the things coming up inside of you and just be with them.
Yeah, no, it's a spiritual experience.
Yeah.
And you're missing, I think, that opportunity if you're distracting yourself with other things. So totally. Absolutely, he doesn't describe it that, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk briefly, as we're closing up here, about your time in hospice and some of the common things that you found as people were in the death process that they revealed that they would have changed, they would have done differently, or just revelations that they had about life and afterlife and experiences, just anything that's top of mind.
Yeah.
For you.
Well, and there's a book by a hospice nurse, The 5 Things That People Say When They're Dying. I can't remember the exact title, but the things that she cites are exactly the same things that I heard. And the first one is, I wish I had the courage to be myself.
Mm.
So this idea of authenticity, that is the most common thing that I would hear from people, is they would say, I wish I hadn't done what everyone else had wanted me to do. I wish I had had the courage to be me.
Mm.
And then the other things are, you know, that I wish that I hadn't worked so much, right? That I hadn't put so much focus on work. I wish I had fostered my relationships. I wish I had stayed connected with those people who were important to me. And then the other thing for me is that there was a realization that, like, nothing was ever going to be finished. You know, that they would say, like, I thought somehow there was like something that I was supposed to do, and now I realize that it was never going to, like, that there was never anything to finish. Like, that it just is, like,
you're
life
is supposed to be in love with the doing itself.
Yeah, like that this is just the experience, and that I wasn't present with the experience. I was looking for the destination that I missed it.
Oh.
So, and for me, being around people who are dying is like one of the biggest gifts, because they just have so much wisdom, and the veil starts to thin. And, you know, there's some studies that say maybe DMT is starting to be released in the brain, but they start to say things that are really profound. Mm.
Yeah. Wow. I'd imagine between that and your shared death experience that, like, your whole perception, I mean, it has to be this way because you're no longer doing what you were doing before, and you were doing that for 20 years, but your just whole perception of life and reality is completely shifted.
Yeah. For sure.
For the better. Yeah. Well, this conversation was awesome. Awesome. Especially, like, anytime I get a chance to talk about water and Dr. Cowan and all in one conversation, I love it. Yeah. So please share with the audience where they can find you and anything that you have going right now.
Sure. So my website is katiedeming.com and my podcast is Born to Heal.
Awesome. Katie, thank you so much for being here. This was amazing.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.